This is the third Euromigos debate. We were joined in the second debate by a Nobel laureate, as you know. We've been joined by David McDermott, welcome, David. Maybe you'd like to introduce yourself. Any awards recently?
Thanks for that introduction, Dr. Powles. No recent awards of that significance.
So what we're discussing today is we're discussing a simple question in intermediate and poor risk clear cell renal cancer. David is arguing that patients should have ipilimumab and nivolumab, and Brian is debating that patients should have PD-1 plus a VEGF-targeted therapy, so axi-pembro, cabo-nivo. David, because you're our guest, would you like to go first?
How is it that I'm your guest? Aren't I part of your amigos?
We need to talk about that. We need to talk about that.
Was I excommunicated at some meeting that I didn't attend?
No, you're still very much
very much part.
But a podcast guest, a podcast.
Okay, that's fine. So at the moment, I don't think this discussion is ripe for debate.
Brilliant.
Well, no, I mean, it's obviously going to be debated and we're going to talk about it ad nauseum, but this is sort of Checkmate 214 is ahead, as you guys know, with follow-up. And in some ways, as long as it's until the VEGF story catches up, in my mind, PD-1 CTLA-4 is going to look better. Not necessarily at achieving the targeted therapy endpoints of response rate and median PFS, but now that we have longer-term follow-up data, 42, 48 months for Nivo Ipi, we can start talking about IO endpoints like long-term survival and landmark progression-free survival, both of which I think are superior to those other endpoints, both from a clinical and from a patient standpoint. I think if we had this discussion with patients involved, if we had this discussions with surgeons involved, we had this discussion with people who do bone marrow transplant, I think all of those people would agree that we should focus on long-term outcomes, not at outcomes that happen at or before the median. Right now, Nivo Ipi has the best data beyond the median. Now, it may turn out that the VEGF story catches up and that when you start looking at progression-free survival at 4 years or 5 years, you'll hit 30%, you'll hit 35% with those strategies. I tend to doubt it, but I'd be glad to be proven wrong. And I think there's no one who tried to advocate more for VEGF PD-1 strategies in the beginning than I did. And I, gave lots of talks and tried to advocate for lots of trials. But to the extent that we're looking for synergy to produce long-term outcomes, I think we're not seeing as much synergy with those approaches as I would have liked to have seen. And I think in the end, the early benefit that you see with VEGF PD-1 is going to fade across all of those trials over time. So that's why I use Nivo Ipi in our patients, at least in the intermediate and poor risk patients. It's obviously a discussion that needs to be had. You need to be very transparent about the risk and about, there's clearly more both long and short-term risk with Nivo Ipi than VEGF PD-1.
What do you mean by that, David?
I think the IO side effects are greater when you add CTLA-4 blockade. So the side effects are the same, but the severity of the side effects, the incidence of the side effects is greater. So you have to be ready to manage them you have to have a team of people ready to manage them in your practice. And you also have patients who need to be educated about the risks and how to call. But if you have those things, Nivo Ipi, I think at the moment is a superior approach than VEGF PD-1.
Hey, Tom, am I ever going to get to talk?
You can go now. You can go now.
I think I tied that up pretty good.
I thought it was fine. Actually,
so here's what I would say. So David focused on long-term endpoints, not inappropriately, but I think sometimes when we do that, we ignore important shorter-term endpoints. So I would say that, especially in an intermediate and poor-risk population who generally have higher tumor burden and more symptomatic disease, I think you can make a cogent argument that tumor shrinkage, lack of early progression and prolongation of median PFS has clinical benefit, that it's clinically meaningful to a larger group of patients then are who are going to be on that the tail of the curve. The other thing I would say is if you look at the landmark 12-month survival, there's about a 7% difference between Ipi-Nivo and Axi-Pembro, right? Comparing across trials, I get it. But, you know, those 7% of patients, you know, who get, in this case, an upfront VEGF inhibitor, you know, they're not alive to get other therapy. So if you miss a window of disease control in a certain subset of patients.
Just expand on that point, you know, for me, Brian.
So the 12-month landmark survival for Ipi-Nivo is 83%. Yes. It's 90% for Axi-Pembro, right? Okay. So comparing across trials, okay. Right? So taking the data for what it's worth, that if you treat with an Ipi-Nivo approach, 7% less of people are going to be alive at 12 months, right? So you're sacrificing patients up front for a hopeful tail of the curve. And even David admits, we don't know what the IO-TKI tail is going to be, right? I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Right? It may or may not be Ipi-Nivo-like or better.
We're
going
to come to toxicity in a second. Let's keep just focusing on the efficacy points if we can for a second. So, David, so there is this argument. So the response rate for Ipi-Nivo is 39%, for Axi-Pembro is 60%, and for Cabo-Nivo is 56%. How, you know, and then, of course, the PFS is 12 for Ipi-Nivo, 15 for 426 and 16 for 9ER for Cabo-Nivo. Well, I think what Brian is saying is this early control is really important. What's your comeback to that?
Well, two things. I think early on in the era of immune checkpoint blockade, I think those of us who advocated for its use did the field and, more importantly, patients a major disservice by this concept of treatment beyond progression, particularly in kidney cancer. And I definitely regret my role in that story. Not that I was first author, but I was there when it happened. And I should have
stopped in the room when it happened.
I was in the room because I think everyone has wishful thinking when you're going with IO therapy. Both patient and clinician want to believe that the therapy is going to produce a long-term positive outcome. So they're willing to stick with it longer than they should in the face of progression.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
So I think if you disabuse yourself of that notion, as hard as it is, and you immediately transfer patients on the 3-month scan or the 6-month scan to say, for the sake of argument, Cabo or Axi, if you started on Ipi-Nivo, I think that those people that fall through the cracks, that number would be smaller. I think
Although there's no evidence of that, right? We don't know that happened on 204.
Correct. You'd have to prove it.
Yeah.
You'd have to prove it, and you'd have to do a trial that was looking at the sequences, which are, as we all know, almost impossible to do sequence trials. But if you did a sequence trial and you flipped everyone on the IO start to VEGF right at the first sign of progression, that gap wouldn't exist. I don't think, because I think you can salvage people, particularly in kidney cancer, with a VEGF inhibitor, as second-line therapy, if you use it soon enough. Now, I can't.
So the pedigree trial may do that, right? I think those patients.
What's the pedigree trial?
Pedigree, you know, Tian's trial that.
No, another trial, but just the audience, maybe.
Oh, takes people who progress on Ipi-Nivo go straight to Cabo. People who are CRs, you know, obviously stay on Ipi-Nivo, and I think everybody in the middle then is randomized to Cabo or nothing, or Cabo or just Nivo.
David, I've got one more question for you and Brian before we go, and because I will then come to Brian, and we're going to talk about PFS in a second. But if we could start with this issue, which people talk about, which is the addition of CTLA-4, the addition of Ipi to Nivo. How much is that contributing?
I think it contributes significantly both to response rate and to, more importantly, to length or duration of response.
So could you give us the data to support your hypothesis there?
Well, I think so. In the trials where we have tested late Ipi, and there are three of them, Titan, Omnivore, and the HCRN trial, when you don't give Ipi up front, your response rate is lower, your CR rate is lower, and some patients don't get Ipi for a variety of reasons. So if you are meaning to give Ipi, eventually you should probably give it up front, which is it's sort of my take home.
And how much do you think it increases 2-year survival by, and how much do you think it increases response rate by?
I think it probably increases response rate by 10 to 15%. And more importantly, I think it increases the ability to be alive at 5 years and the ability to come off treatment, which I think is another endpoint.
Here we go. I knew that was coming.
listen. All I'm saying is I can debate you guys and lose because it's too
No, 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 no. But if there was...
Comes the moderator.
I'm across to Brian in a second. We just wanted to go with you first.
Okay, but listen.
Get uncomfortable.
I understand. But if there was a patient in the room here in this debate, I would win easy. Because
I don't think you would.
I think we would because if the question was you're equally likely to be alive with treatment A or treatment B, but you're twice as likely to be alive off treatment. If you go with treatment A, I think many patients, not all.
David, we're going to come to toxicity and treatment-free survival in a minute. The response rate for pembrolizumab in your 427 study is 39%, and the response rate for ipi-nivo is 40%. What does that look like for you? So because you said there is a bump in response, how convinced are you of that bump in response? Or do you think actually most of the benefit is actually long-term and much harder and more subtle to measure?
Yeah, I think you should. I don't think you should. As proud as we are of KEYNOTE-427, I don't think we should throw that into the mix here right now because that result was better than anyone expected.
I'll take that.
Just look at the...
Should ignore data that doesn't support the argument.
No, it does. It does. But do that study with Pembro and IPRI and see what you get. Okay.
Let's take the other side. We're going to come to treatment.
Let me answer the question.
Well, I did give you an opportunity 3 or 4 times. Okay.
No, when you do look at HCRN, look at Omnivore, look at Titan, there is a response rate to the addition of IPI. It's not high, but it's there. So I think IPI is adding something. You lose something if you don't give it up front. If your goal is long term and your goal is CR, you lose something if you don't give it up front.
So, Brian, the main criticism that I'm receiving at the moment around Axi Pembro is as the data matures, the PFS curve doesn't seem to be plateauing. What's your comeback to that? And the concern is, and of course, the other concern is the hazard ratio is drifting in a downward direction from 0.53 to 0.68. Yeah. So what's the comeback to saying that actually you're getting great initial control, but without the CTLA-4, you're struggling at these landmarks and the data's not so great? And coming back to David's point, what patients really want is long-term durable remission, not a good few days at the races during the first 6 months.
So I think it's too early to tell. I think the jury's still out. I'd be the first to admit that. I just don't think, and I think David said this up front, there's not a long enough follow-up for us to know what that tail's going to be. Is it going to plateau, number one? And if so, is it going to be ipi-nivo-like at 30-ish percent at 4 years or some other number? I have a hypothesis, actually, that the VEGF therapy is more important up front for disease control, and then the immune therapy kicks in. And David just said CTLA-4 is important up front as well. So it's sort of a side debate over how we should sequence these if we're developing triplets, which we kind of had the other day. But to answer your question, I just think it's too early. We just don't know.
If it is too early and long-term outcomes are important, then David's original point, which is go with long and safe, is the correct position.
If you only care about proven long-term outcomes, right, then yeah, ipi-nivo is ahead because it's 2 years more mature, right? So not having the data doesn't mean it won't turn out that way. And early disease control is important, right? So you can't just ignore, right? You can't say, well, I'm going to only pick this one endpoint that's important and I have the most mature data and therefore I win, right? That's in essence the argument.
Okay, so let's come to the toxicity issue. the toxicity issue, I think, is complicated because what patients want is they want to be in control of disease with long-term benefit without too much toxicity. David was very transparent when he said that immune combination therapy is more difficult to give. Did you say it was more difficult to give than VEGF plus immune therapy? Was that the premise?
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
Correct. You have to be paying more attention to your patients to give it.
But the quality of life data, why don't you have a second on toxicity? Don't go for this treatment-free stuff. We'll come to that in a minute. Please. Just, I think, give me the bottom line on the management of this, and why you feel the management, if you do feel, what are the advantages of the management of IPNEVO versus Axipounder?
So in general, I think there's no more easier therapy to take than in oncology, you know, than PD-1 single agent after the first 6 months. Meaning, it's not to say it's free of side effects, but it's uncommon to develop new side effects over that time. So patients generally feel pretty good from a quality of life standpoint in that period. In the first 6 months, there can be risk that's amplified by the addition of CTLA-4, and you have to be paying attention. But early intervention can ameliorate most, but not all, of those side effects. But it takes more attention by the clinician, and it takes a team of physicians to manage those patients, which is not the same for VEGF-PD-1. Whereas VEGF-PD-1, I think the ride is more consistent. What you're feeling month 3 is pretty similar to what you're going to be feeling month 12. I think there, though, the chronic annoying side effects get to patients over time. There's a trade-off. So that's probably why it was harder to show quality of life improvements in the AxiPembro trial, although you could make a lot of points about, I'm sure Brian will, about how quality of life is hard to measure.
Oh, what about the CABO-NIVO trial did show better quality of life?
Right, and how it was measured at different time points. And if you measure it 2 weeks after Sutent, gosh, you know, it feels like someone just stepped off your head, so you feel better. I think it's a little bit dicey to compare CABO-NIVO and AxiPembro on quality of life. I think most of us have a sense that those combinations provide a similar level of tox, and Axi in some ways, and at least in my experience, is easier to give and easier to take, from a patient's point of view. But the data doesn't back that up at the moment.
Okay, Brian, just over to you quickly. I think toxicity.
I think David just made all my points. He made all my points for me.
What's the question? Advantages of AxiPembro from a toxicity perspective over IPNEVO.
Yeah, I think as David says, I agree. IPNEVO is more upfront inflammatory toxicity, but when you get to maintenance NEVO, it's generally pretty easy, whereas AxiPembro is certainly less upfront. Let me finish. I would parenthetically note that I think sometimes people think it's too easy, meaning I always tell patients there's a couple month adjustment period, even on single agent TKI, let alone combo. And so we shouldn't, there needs to be an investment by provider and nurse, et cetera, to manage symptoms and dose and stuff during that time. But anyway, it's a little easier up front. But then you carry the chronic toxicities, which I think can be managed, and I think are a little bit overstated, in this discussion. We've been using TKIs for years, right? So I think they're a little bit overstated, but I agree.
And just
could
you give me
2
seconds on AxiPembro and CABO-NIVO? Some people are saying because the CABO is at 40 and there are lots of dose reductions. And, what's your feeling on the dosing of AxiPembro and CABO-NIVO? Obviously, Axi has personalized dosing. You can go up and go down. CABO, it looks like many patients go from 40 down to 20. What's your take on that whole issue?
Right. I mean, it's more complicated than 2 seconds. Right. I would agree, as David said, I don't think the quality of life is really measuring what we think it is. And those CABO-NIVO changes were not in the clinically meaningful range, even if they were different between the arms. So I don't know. Dosing, I think if you ask, like David said, my general experience is Axi is an easier drug. Right. And I still believe that even with CABO at 40. Right. And again, half the patients had to go down to 20. But in general, I think you could call them sort of broadly similar in terms of side effect profile for an IOT.
Now, David,
regimen.
This is outside of the debate topic.
No.
But you did at the beginning show a preference to include good risk patients in this debate. I was not keen to do that because I thought you were putting yourself at a disadvantage. But you were very keen for us to talk about good risk patients quickly. Just talk about your approach to good risk patients and we'll then ask Brian the same question. This, by the way, is outside of the direct discussion around the debate.
So, yeah, in my practice, our practice, we don't change based on IMDC risk. We could get into the debate about whether IMDC is relevant in the era of PD-1 blockade, but we probably should skip that. I think it's probably less relevant. That said, the good risk patients in CheckMate 214 do very well. You know, it's not like they do poorly. It's just that Sutent outperforms, you know, not surprisingly, in IMDC good risk as it relates to response and progression.
But you would want the drug that does outperform. That's not, you wouldn't want to, just if two groups are doing well,
no,
you wouldn't want to piss the worst and
not
the slightly less good.
No, because a good risk patient by definition, and Dr. Rinney has taught us this for many years, those patients are asymptomatic. They have no problems. Okay. So good risk patients have no symptoms. So you're giving them symptoms for treatment. And there's got to be a good reason. And what I say is a good reason is if you can produce great long-term overall survival in that group, okay. If you can produce more CRs in that group, let's go. If you like, you know, high-dose IL-2, if you want to produce more treatment-free survival in that group, then treatment is worth it. And what treatment provides that?
Brian,
is
over to you, Brian. Over so, to you. Just this, you can cut this.
I
know.
David's just getting fired up. I'm loving it.
Yeah. So listen, just let me fit one more sentence. And this is a paper that you were going to be on until you started this morning in the CheckMate 214 trial. All right. So treatment-free survival is twice as long in the intermediate and poor risk group and three times as long in the good risk group if you got ipi-nivo first. So you're not just alive, you're alive off drug. So there's some benefit.
I'm Brian, over to you.
David, quoting unpublished data, I love it.
No, it was presented.
I think it's obvious that number one, I don't think all favorable risk patients are completely asymptomatic. That's not part of the definition, so I don't think that's the case. They clearly have a more favorable biology, and they have a VEGF-driven biology, right? That's the way IMDC was defined, was correct, from VEGF therapy. So by definition, they are VEGF responsive. So it makes imminent sense to include a VEGF inhibitor in their treatment, and not only get the short-term endpoints of ORR and PFS, but get long-term, you know, long-term
Let's
survival.
Let's move and wrap
well.
This up now. David, you first. A couple have said, okay, Brian,
he
you
always
first.
Goes I first.
I don't mind. Brian, you first. Please outline your crystallized argument in a couple of sentences why
crystallized.
In intermediate and poorest patients, you should be giving VEGF TKI plus immune therapy and not ipi-nivo.
I think there's strong efficacy signals across endpoints, you know, for those patients, including upfront disease control, you know, lack of early progression, disease control is measured by high response rate, a CR rate that's ipi-nivo-like, and a long progression-free survival. The toxicity is manageable in a community setting. Not everybody is at Beth Israel in a specialized center where they can handle ipi-nivo. So broad-based community setting, I think most providers can handle an axi-pembro toxicity, but
over
may
to
struggle
you, David.
With an ipi-nivo toxicity.
So I think the endpoints that matter to patients, ipi-nivo is superior, at least at the moment. So there's a hierarchy of endpoints, and landmark PFS, long-term OS, treatment-free survival are all better. If we were playing poker, that's a full house compared to
I think
know, Brian's got
five
like two
cards.
Pair.
Yeah, full house,
five, right? Okay, so never mind. So, but ultimately, we'll have to wait and see. You know, we'll have to see what, you know, come back 2 years from now, if those endpoints are as good with VEGF, you know, based combinations, then we'll change our approach. But I don't think they will be, because I think the effect of VEGF is helpful in the first 6 to 12 months. And you could make an argument that it might be harmful to an ongoing immune response after that time. We'll see. The data is the data, as Brian likes to say.
So to summarize,
I look forward.
And David, I agree with you. I think the VEGF is more important up front, and I'd love to see trials that, you know, stop it at some point. I'm not
David,
sure.
David, are you excited about right. the triplet study, COSMIC 313, ipi-nivo versus cabo ipi-nivo?
I hope to be. It's certainly going to produce more cost and toxicity. I want to see a CR rate that's over 20%. If not, I'm not going to be that excited about it because I think it's going to be very hard to apply for a variety of reasons in the places where most patients get treated. I'd be much more excited about novel combinations that were given to, you know, certain patients based on an understanding of their tumor microenvironment as opposed to just everything at once. But
yeah,
you should have been in the debate yesterday.
I I understand that. I was banging my head against my computer screen, but you know, we'll see. That's not where the field is.
Can I make one last point?
Yes.
So, David, you always say that your longer term endpoints are most important to patients. Is there any data from patients to suggest that? I mean, do we have any patient surveys or data that would sort of balance that, you know, short-term response rate PFS versus long-term? I don't know. I'm not saying there isn't. I'm not aware of it. And it would be an easy thing.
It would be an interesting question. I saw a patient 20 minutes ago. And when I was talking about Ipi-Nivo and VEGF TKI immune therapy, and, you know, he was initially attracted to the high response rate. You know, he said, let's go for the one. The response rate of 40%, he wasn't attracted to. And of course, there's the more subtle story that you're talking about, David. But I guess there is an issue around what, because patient education is really important here. Brian, I've got the last question for you about the clear.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear about the clear trial.
I'm here.
The clear trial is Pembro plus Levat versus Levat plus everolimus versus sunitinib, the last of these frontline trials. How excited are you about that study? Yep.
I wouldn't say excited. I expect it to be positive. I expect the IOTKI story to continue. I expect the numbers to be similar to, you know, axi-pembro cabo-nivo. I don't know of a good reason they wouldn't be similar. You know, the len-ev arm is sort of a curveball in this and how it will perform. And, you know, but if you sort of take that part out of it, I don't expect any surprises, but that's why
so
we do the trial.
I think we're going to draw a line under it there. David, anything else you'd like to add?
Beautiful.
I think patient-reported outcomes are important. I think patients, you know, what patients want is important. I don't think, like I said, if we were talking about this with our patients and giving them all of the information, I think they would choose, some of them would choose more aggressive strategies. We just have to
David, why give didn't them you the data. Put, why didn't you talk about CR? Brian, why didn't you talk about CR?
I don't think CR, I think durable response is really the endpoint, not just CRs. And I think David would agree with that. And again, the CR rates are similar, but we just don't know durability.
So I was expecting you to come out on your CR horse at one point, David, and that horse never came out of the stable. Why was that?
I think it's important not to make big deals about small differences in trials. And this goes for IO versus VEGF PD-1 comparisons and all of these stupid VEGF PD-1 comparisons that we're doing about bone mets and quality of life and all of that stuff. I understand, but it's not statistically robust. We need head-to-head comparisons before it. Otherwise, you should keep your mouth shut.
On that note, I think we're going to draw a line.
I agree.
David, Brian, thanks so much.
Awesome.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thanks, gents.
All right. Be good.